You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, North Korea claims to have developed a fleet of missile-capable submarines. South Korea claims to believe them. Should we? Also ahead.
Our first priority is to save lives and prevent further loss of life at sea. And we believe in the European Union that this is a responsibility that we all share, not only as Europeans, but also globally.
The EU's foreign policy chief says it must save the lives of thousands of migrants risking death trying to enter its territory. As the European Commission suggests that EU members accept refugees under a quota scheme, we'll get the view from our guests today, John Everard and Kathleen Burke. Also on today's programme, it's crunch time again for, you guessed it, Greece. We'll ask what the future holds for the defiant, debt-ridden state. Plus, we look to the United States, where a summit of Gulf leaders at Camp David this week may well be a somewhat sparse affair. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at University College here in London, and John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, among other bailiwicks, and author of the Pyongyang memoir Only Beautiful Please. Welcome both. And we will start tonight with North Korea, which now, as ever, is making the proverbial riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma look like the quick crossword in the Daily Star. Earlier this week, North Korea's erratically reliable official media posted photographs of Kim Jong-un pointing at what was either a submarine missile launch or semi-plausible Photoshop. All elsewhere, it was reported for far from the first time that Washington and Beijing were seeking to restart talks with Pyongyang over its nuclear program. John, first and foremost, on balance, all things considered, etc., are we buying the submarine missile pictures?
Probably, yes. Everybody has, all the experts have pored over these photos. The actual launch bit looks genuine. A lot of people say that the presence of Kim Jong-un was photoshopped in, but that's hardly surprising and actually not that important. You wouldn't want to put the young leader quite so close to anything nasty like a submarine launch, would you?
Well, okay.
We'll leave that a later discussion. But the actual launch does seem to have taken place. And there's a bit of background to this, that for a while the experts have been warning that the North Koreans have been upgrading their missiles, and specifically that they appear to have adapted one of the submarines for a single launch missile. So this didn't come as a total surprise, but the speed with which they'd advanced to this point did.
Kathleen, the South Koreans are now saying that North Korea could have a missile-capable submarine fleet within 5 years. North Korea, of course, are saying they have one now. Do we think the South Koreans actually believe that, or are they pretending to believe that in order to, you know, ratchet up pressure on the North and bring more people around to their way of thinking, etc.?
Especially from the Americans. I mean, in the first place, the South Korean fleet dates from Soviet times. That means over 25 years old. They would have to be fitted so they could actually properly hold and have the software to do it. Secondly, and this is probably more important, you have to be able to have the warhead small enough to go on the end of a missile. That's rather more difficult than it sounds. It sounds pretty difficult to me, but you know what I mean. I think the South Koreans quite rightly are worried, even though this particular missile could only go 150 meters, one gathers. Nevertheless, that's going to get better. And I think South Korean friends I have who are not ambassadors, but not street cleaners, as it were, are apprehensive. Not only because of that, but because I think they're not sure the Americans will react quickly enough.
Yeah. There's been a lot of talk about just what kind of missile this is. The best bet is that this is a North Korean clone of an old Soviet missile, which would give it a range of over 1,000 kilometers. If they have indeed mastered this this technology, then questions like, can they get a nuclear warhead on top? I mean, they're important, but they almost become secondary, because if you can launch a missile from a submarine, you can drive your submarine to within reach of where do you want? San Francisco, LA, and fire just an ordinary conventional warhead. And knocking down a couple of skyscrapers in central Los Angeles would probably make your point quite adequately.
It would be quite a journey, though, across the Pacific and in some of those submarines.
They're still going submarines, they can do it.
Yeah, well, okay, would they get back?
Does it matter?
Possibly to those inside the submarine, yes.
No, I mean, quite typically, North Korean submarine crews are ordered at the end of their mission or, if they face capture, to commit mass suicide. They do that.
On that happy thought, John, is there... The idea of a missile-capable North Korean submarine fleet is obviously no fun for anybody, but given the range and given the possibilities that it would have, would it mark the point at which other concerned countries, especially South Korea, China, and the United States, may lose patience with Pyongyang entirely? And how sound, I guess, as a related question, is Pyongyang's understanding of how far they can push their luck?
I think patience with Pyongyang is eroding rapidly. It's certainly eroded on the Chinese side. The Chinese haven't been talking to the North Koreans for quite some time now. And experts who will be watching trade have said that China hasn't supplied North Korea with oil for over a year now, which makes you wonder where North Korea is getting its oil from. So the Chinese are seriously annoyed. An expert who actually takes part in the negotiations told me just a few days ago that one of the side effects of Kim Jong-un's famous no-show in Moscow is that up until that was announced, the Russians were playing tough with the other partners in the negotiations, often taking the North Korean side. Once Putin had been humiliated in this way, all of a sudden the Russians just joined the consensus of the five. So North Korea now faces a solid block of international opinion. The big question is, though, what do you do? We've tried sanctions for many years. As we've seen, they probably slowed North Korean programs. They certainly haven't stopped them. You could probably devise bigger and better sanctions, but are even they going to work? And nobody wants to try a military solution, not just because it means lots of body bags, but because the North Koreans are so deeply dug in. They have got a tunnel complex between Pyongyang and the South Korean border that makes Tora Bora look like a kid playing in a sandpit. It is huge. It is immensely well protected. It would take years to take out. If you ever did attempt to impose a military solution on North Korea, you'll be fighting there for a very, very long time.
Kathleen, there's this story doing the rounds again today, most notably in the Financial Times, about the US and China wanting to restart talks. Does that strike you as significant? Or because it actually struck me that the headline would have been more significant if it had been announced that the US and China didn't want to restart talks. I would have assumed that wanting to restart talks was a more or less permanent condition.
Well, I must say that the two of them working together is of more importance, I suspect, in general terms, than whether they're going to talk about North Korea. Something has to be done. People have to at least have a go, I think. I shouldn't have thought anyone has too high expectations. But as John said, there's now a solid block on the so-called group of six. And if China and the U.S. quite obviously are coming together, that might give North Korea a bit of a start.
John, just at the heart of this, it's always struck me, and I don't know whether you think this idea of a submarine fleet makes any difference, that there is it's an unpleasant and uneasy but extant balance of fear, stroke, terror, power, call it whatever you will, that North Korea must understand that if they were to actually launch any genuine offensive operation against the South Korea or China or, heaven forfend, the United States, it would be the last thing the regime ever did. They must understand that.
I'm not confident they do. The North Koreans have, I think, over a period of years now, talked themselves into all kinds of beliefs that to us seem really quite bizarre. You hear North Korean officials, including quite senior officials, talking about a lightning strike on the South to take all its money and to solve North Korea's economic problems, without any kind of grasp of the fact that if you drop a bomb on the South, you're likely to get one dropped back on you. I mean, common sense would support exactly what you said, but I'm not sure there's a whole lot of common sense in Pyongyang right now.
Is there anything to be gained? Just a final thought on this, Kathleen. Is there actually anything to be gained by talking to Pyongyang, do you think, other than the hope that if we carry on talking to them long enough, eventually this regime will collapse under the weight of its own lunacy?
Well, collapse is difficult. They've already had a famine and several million people died. I mean, it's hard to know what you can actually do. Jaw-jaw rather than war, I think. what one gathers that at the beginning, what they hoped is usually they'll threaten and the U.S. will back down and give them nuclear, not help, but I mean, and stand off. And I think when Jong-un came into power, that the idea was he could do this daring of the United States again. It hasn't worked. So what are they going to do? They're going to threaten military. What is the U.S. and the rest going to do? They're going to say, no, you won't, because we'll bomb you. Alternatively, try to get them down to a table. I mean, I think it's this question of managing and holding things off. I don't know what John thinks there, but it seems to me that there's nothing anyone can actually do at this point, because what can they offer North Korea that they want?
Not a great deal. North Korea has already said that it is not going to relinquish its nuclear weapons. There's
exactly
a famous quote that if the United States wants the Korean Peninsula to denuclearize, then it needs first to arrange for the rest of the world to denuclearize, which is quite a tough yardstick. So what is the point, say the Americans, of talks towards denuclearization when it is painfully clear that North Korea does not have the slightest intention of denuclearizing? And that is a question that the Chinese, who have been trying to get these talks restarted, have yet to produce a sensible answer to. Jawdraw rather than war, absolutely. But the problem is, though, that while this jawdraw is, or rather isn't, going on, North Korea is all the time developing its weapons, improving its nuclear weaponry, launching missiles from submarines now. And you quite soon get to the stage where, firstly, any military solution to the problem, difficult as it was at the beginning, becomes virtually suicidal. And secondly, you get to the stage where North Korea might believe that it can use a thing like a submarine-launched missile, probably developed as a second-strike capability, as first strike. You give us money or else we take out one of your cities. What do we do then?
Well, continuing seamlessly, we shall move along, continuing seamlessly on the theme of bewildered outside powers trying to figure out what to do with an apparently incorrigible broken down basket case in their approximate midst. Eurozone finance ministers have today been conducting their umpty dozenth crisis meeting about Greece. Greece has or is about to pay the IMF the 750 million euros due tomorrow, but that is only the first of a number of large checks which need to be written by Athens in coming months, and Greece does not, to reduce the reams of technical arcana to the salient point, have any money. Kathleen, is this, I lose track at this point. We have done so many Greek crisis deadlines, last ditch scenario stories at this point. Is this more serious than all the others?
Well, the problem is that Greece has pretty well run out of hidden pots of money. I mean, John and I were discussing this earlier, and they're about left with bake sales. If if they can pay this 700 and it's called 40 or 50 or 80 million euros to the IMF, and you do not pay the IMF, because if you don't pay the IMF, that's your lot. There's no place else to get any money. So they pay the IMF, but the hope is that they then, that the EU then turns over the 7.2 billion euros that theoretically Greece has already been promised, and that's been held back because Greece will not do anything. Greece has alienated its friends, it's alienated its allies, the people don't like the approach. Varoufakis may be a rock star, but you don't use rock stars in negotiations with the German finance minister.
So they have
very little sympathy for them.
I'm just thinking some of the rock stars with whom I have professionally interacted, and yes, I can confirm that in every case that would be a completely terrible idea. Although entertaining to watch.
Well, okay, but the point is that Greece, this is virtually the end of the line. Greece doesn't think it is, clearly. They keep saying, well, it's almost there, and before anything happens, we'll come to some sort of agreement. That's what they keep saying. And if they actually believe that, they're going to come a cropper. If they pay tomorrow, heaven knows where the money will come from, that will buy a few more days, but not a lot more than that. And then what are they going to do?
Well, John, this is always the question. Is the cropper actually ever going to come? There is a statement apparently expected very, very imminently out of this latest crisis conclave. Greece has paid the 750 million euros. Some of the pre-briefing announcement chatter rumour was actually vaguely positive, suggesting some sort of deal might be struck. But is this just going to be kicking the can down the road again?
Yes.
At what point does the EU say, that's it, enough?
The answer to the second question is quite straightforward. It says so next month, because that is when the EU bailout deal comes to an end. And unless Greece does some kind of deal with the EU to roll this bailout deal forward, then the 7.2 billion euros just disappear from the table, because the whole agreement times out. And Greece is left with nothing except a very, very large bill and a very, very large debt, which it simply cannot afford to pay. And that's not a political judgment. That is just cruel arithmetic. So you asked at the beginning of this, we've seen crisis after crisis and crunch after crunch. Yes, but they're getting worse and worse and worse simply because the clock is ticking towards that day. We're now only, what, a month and a half away.
And one real problem there, of course, is that in terms of those countries which have already bitten the bullet and suffered terribly, Ireland, for example, Portugal, for example, they sweated blood, and they, amongst many of them, are not going to give Greece wiggle room that Greece thinks it's going to get.
Because does it strike you, Kathleen, further on that point, that the EU is, if not necessarily relaxed about the idea of Greece leaving the EU or the euro, it's less worried about it than it might have been 3 years ago? It's no longer perceived as the end of days, is it?
No, and planning has been in train for 2 or 3 weeks about what one will actually do. No, I mean, the point is that it comes a point where the game isn't worth the candle. Greece won't save itself. It won't take the decisions, or they won't implement the decisions that it feels that it would like. Greece thinks, because the democracy ruled in Greece, that the EU shouldn't boggle at the 240 billion that it's already supplied to Greece. Greece thinks it deserves it. Heaven knows why.
Yeah.
And the EU is just fed up.
Absolutely. I think you put your finger on a very important point, Kathleen. It's important to understand that a lot of the Syriza people, and Varoufakis in particular, not many months ago, these guys were sitting around cafes in Athens, smoking cigarettes and criticizing the contradiction to capitalism. They feel victimhood. They feel that the EU owes them a lot. And the fact that these wicked bankers are simply saying no, they regard as simply oppression of the Greek people. The Greece is owed, morally owed this money, and the EU ought just to cough up. It's a worldview that I think many of us have trouble understanding, but is nevertheless passionately held by them and by a lot of other Greeks too.
Well, we shall doubtless revisit that one when the next red envelope arrives on the doormat in Athens next week or next month or whenever it is. We will be taking a short break right now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, John Everard and Kathleen Burke will be here when we come back. Coming up next, the EU's ongoing wrangles with its other great intractable, that of the unceasing armada of boat-borne migrants from Africa and the Middle East. And what if they gave a Middle East summit and nobody came? Stay tuned.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, the Monocle Travel Guides. Speaking in an informed but informal way about everything from architecture to art, late night bars to early morning markets, the Monocle Travel Guides mix the classic with the contemporary, going beyond the conventional and revealing the hidden spots that cities have to offer. Published by Gestalten, these travel guides are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists in the world's great cities. These series kicks off with London and New York, available now in Monocle shops, at monocle.com, and in all good bookstores. And watch out for Hong Kong and Tokyo on the way soon. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse, and eminently digestible world of food, drink, and hospitality every week. Join me, Marcus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs, and trade secrets with our Asia editor at large, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month, a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are John Everard, former UK ambassador to Belarus, Ukraine and North Korea, and Kathleen Burke, professor emerita of modern and contemporary history at UCL. Now, more than 60,000 migrants have attempted the Mediterranean crossing so far this year. At least 1,800 of them have drowned in the attempt. Despite those dreadful risks, the boats keep on coming, but practical and humane ideas about what to do with their occupants are in shorter supply. The European Commission plans to suggest that EU nations be apportioned quotas of migrants to relieve pressure on frontline countries like Italy and Malta. Kathleen, this suggestion has already been greeted with, rank lack of enthusiasm and indeed raucous laughter from many EU countries. So given that nobody is going to agree to this, why is the European Commission proposing it?
Let's say desperation. Shall we try desperation? I mean, the point is that 140,000 last year, I think, are coming. You have to do something with them. Germany has got 200,000 already. Italy is staggering. And the hope is, I suppose, those in the Commission who don't possibly get outside enough think that all of these, this great European Union, will pull together and do something. And giving them homes seems to be the only thing possible. Of course, that's going to be never-ending. I mean, there are alternatives, of course. It's been proposed. You go bomb the boats. You need, in fact, several members of the Security Council, Britain, the U.S., Britain, and Lithuania, are proposing that the U.N. authorize force under Article 7, which you, to maintain peace, you can use force. I like that one. Libya says, don't you dare do that. You might hit fishermen. Why don't you just give us arms and we'll take care of it ourselves? It's a total mess. And the problem is, everyone sees what the problem is, but no one really knows what to do about it and what to do about it that would have the support of the domestic publics.
But that right there is the key. And John, it strikes me, and it's an incredibly bleak thought, but it strikes me that at the heart of this, from the point of view of the EU's leaders, all of whom are elected and responsible to the concerns of their domestic constituencies, most of those domestic constituencies are either indifferent to these people or actively hostile.
Well, yes, that's right. I don't know if it's most. Germany and Italy have both spoken out in favour of the Commission proposal. It's noticeable that the countries that speak out in favour of strong humanitarian imperatives tend to be the ones who would find their migrant burden reduced if the Commission's proposal was taken forward. So, you know, it may not be entirely altruistic. But, yeah, Germany... the UK come out very sharply, so a lot of the northern EU members. A telling silence from France and from Spain, but certainly not a warm welcome. The problem, you asked at the beginning of this, why the Commission has put this forward. The Commission's track record on judging member states' reaction is abysmal. And here it goes again. Not only does it put out an idea that surely, you know, 10 minutes reflection would have told it was not going to go down well in all capitals. It does so days after a British general election, which, of course, is a political gift, you know, to David Cameron to torpedo the idea. And it does so suggesting that quotas be set by whom? The implication is by the Commission. So that the system would mean the Commission in Brussels telling member states how many people they had to accept. Hairs go up on the back of necks all over Europe over that.
Okay, well, we should look finally tonight towards the United States. 37 years ago this September, the US presidential retreat Camp David became synonymous with hopes for Middle East peace when the otherwise hapless Jimmy Carter persuaded Menachem Begin of Israel and Anwar Sadat of Egypt to come to terms. Possibly with this in mind, President Barack Obama will be using the same venue for his own Middle East summit this week, although he may be setting a smaller table than he anticipated. The kings of Saudi Arabia, Oman, the UAE and Bahrain won't be coming. Now, John, you speak fluent diplomatic ease, of course. The Saudis have been at pains to suggest that this isn't a snub.
Yes, and they're probably right, although it makes such a good story.
Does that actually translate as isn't a snub? Because I would have thought that isn't a snub in diplomatic ease translated as, you know, exactly that.
You've been in journalism far too long, Andrew.
I clearly have.
No, no, no. This isn't a snub tends to mean this isn't a snub. And if you say that publicly, that's usually what it means. Remember that, firstly, the Saudis are effectively waging a war at the moment, which tends to keep kings busy. The other thing to remember is King Salman is 80 years old. You know, jetting around at that age puts a sort of burden on the physical frame that, you know, that might have made the Saudis think twice. He has rung the president to explain why he couldn't come. If you're snubbing somebody, you don't do that.
And one thing that one might add there is that he's new to power, and there's apparently some internal objection, shall we say, in the extended Saudi family. And perhaps he thinks as well that this isn't a good time to leave the country. And has he not been ill, John?
He has been ill. There have been questions over his health. Another point here is that he'll be represented by the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who is new and untested. And a lot of the American officials have been saying this will be a really good opportunity to get to know him, and also to give him some real diplomatic practice. You cannot have everything depending on the decisions of one 80-year-old man.
There have been some suggestions, though, Kathleen, that the Saudis are somewhat miffed with the United States at the moment over a variety of things. Obviously, their discussions with Iran. But there's also some suggestion, quite well-sourced suggestion, that the Saudis are still annoyed with the US for not bombing Syria in 2013. My question would be, I guess, if the Saudis were that worried, why don't they do it themselves? They've got an air force.
One can think of all sorts of reasons for that. First of all, it's quite nice to have the United States do it. The United States has broad shoulders. Secondly, the United States is rather further away from Iranian airlines or even Syrian planes. Thirdly, Saudi Arabia tends to bomb or to invade countries rather closer to itself. Iran, on the whole, is a far piece away. But, Saudi Arabia is used to having the United States, not precisely at its beck and call, but when oil was so important, it could count on the, at least, what term do I want to use, to be on its side, in a sense. And that's no longer the case. Iran, with its nuclear things, nuclear weapons, or possible nuclear weapons, is a country that has to be carefully treated, and they can't go romping around Iran in the way that Saudi Arabia would quite like. And Obama's different from his predecessors.
John, even if all those reasons for King Salman not showing are perfectly legitimate, although I, for one, would argue that if the head of state can't survive the, I'm sure, none too rigorous trip on his official jet, then he's possibly not best place to do the job at all in the first place.
A lot of people are saying just that.
Well, indeed. So why might the other kings be blowing the US off? Oman, UAE and Bahrain? Is that entirely out of in sympathy with the Saudis?
I don't know. And I haven't seen any statements from any of those royal families explaining their absences. It may be that they too have been ringing to say, sorry, there are good reasons why we can't do this. Or it may be that for different reasons those people are trying to stop the Americans. I don't think we've got an answer to that yet.
Surely Bahrain is not going to do something that would upset the Saudis. So if the Saudis were trying to make a statement, which you've argued quite rightly, I should have thought, when they say they're not snubbing, they mean not stubbing. On the other hand, Bahrain was the beneficiary of Saudi troops to try to put down an uprising, which they saw as being Shia being run by another country.
Yeah.
So, on the other hand, Bahrain has the U.S. Fifth Fleet there.
Well, yes, that's right. It may be that this is just the Bahrainis being very, very careful.
Yeah.
it may be something that can completely alien to that. We don't know. And until these governments actually tell us what is going on, we're just guessing.
Okay, well, we shall certainly be discussing the consequences of that summit, if indeed there are any, on Midori House or other programs on next week. For the moment, we will have to leave it there. John Everard and Kathleen Burke, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Alice Block, researched by David Pleasant and Sarah Monetta. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Josh Fennett will keep you company with Monocle's international playlist on the Atlantic Shift. At 1900 hours, you can hear Robert Bound with the Culture Programme. At 2200, I'm back with Dom Reynolds for today's Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at 1800 tomorrow, London time. But for this edition, goodbye and thanks for listening.